Let's turn to Matthew chapter 5 and, Lord willing, continue our exposition of the Sermon on the Mount. And here, as we conclude the fifth chapter, we've been seeing the contrast in Jesus' sermon to his disciples. This is what you've heard been taught, but I say unto you. And then in chapter 6, he shifts to not what you've heard, but what you have seen. This is what you've seen modeled for you as what righteousness is or what religion is. And he presents the right perspective in those areas of almsgiving and prayer and fasting and those things. But I think our study today, our message today, is probably one of the pinnacle examples of just how different the kingdom of God is different than the kingdoms of men. Jesus said later on before Pilate, he said, "My kingdom is not of this world." And he specifically said there, "If my kingdom was of this world, my servants would fight." In other words, if they tried to take me prisoner and hold these trials when I am very much innocent, and he was declared to be innocent, they would try to break me out of prison, right? They would try to deal with this in a military way. But our kingdom is a spiritual kingdom. It's righteousness, joy, and peace in the Holy Ghost. It's the kingdom of God is within you, Jesus said later on in his ministry. But our lesson today about loving our enemies, blessing them that curse you, doing good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that is so contrary to our flesh, and it's so contrary to the world. Jesus is very clearly highlighting, my kingdom is categorically different than this world, and it's also categorically different than your flesh. You know, you have these natural inclinations that everybody has, and my kingdom is held to a higher standard. He's been telling us all through that in our study that we've highlighted for you before, is blessed are the pure in heart. And it's hard to not harbor animosity and want to, you know, previously we've talked about not exhibiting as a child of God, as a disciple of Christ, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Well, the person you really want to, if that was correct, the person you really want to hold to my righteous ability to attack their eye, if they attack my eye and punch their tooth out, the person you really want to do that to is your enemy, right? So that's why he says, verse 43, ye have heard that it hath been said. This is what you've been taught in synagogue, okay? And we've been highlighting for you as we've been studying here in the Sermon on the Mount, just the abject spiritual darkness that the Jews were in because of 400 silent years. And, you know, rarely, do people just fabricate things. Most of the time what they do is they take something that God said and they put their own little perspective on it and their own little preference on it and their own little spin on it. Now, it certainly says, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. But you know what? God did not expressly give them a definition of what a neighbor was. So you know what man in his flesh gravitates to? I want to draw the definition of that neighbor to be so narrowly constricted that it's really just the people I like. I really only got to be people nice to the people that I like. But if I don't like you, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. And then probably where they extrapolated that from, you know, I think we saw that with the Lord's lesson on divorce. They took language and they imposed their own very broad definition of it that did not represent what God intended at all. It's probably something like this Deuteronomy 23. It's probably something like this of where they try to extrapolate that from. Deuteronomy 23, verse 3, an Ammonite and a Moabite. So the non-Jews, the Ammonite and the Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord. Even to the tenth generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever, because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor, and Pethor, the son of, of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. Nevertheless, the Lord thy God will not hearken unto Balaam, and the Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing, because the Lord hath loved thee. And this is probably what they really hung on to. Thou shalt not seek their peace, nor their prosperity, all their days forever. So, you know, you give man a little bit of sinful man, a little bit of kindling, and you know what they take that to mean? Well, we get to hate everybody that ain't a Jew, right? we're not going to seek their prosperity, and we don't like them anyway. So obviously the Lord agrees with me, right? The Lord agrees with the people I don't like. So not only do I not have to show love to them, I've got the biblical right to hate people that are different than me, that hate people that are of a different ethnicity than me, that have a different background than me. Well, that's what, I mean, that gravitates to our flesh, you know? And he highlights this, let's read the whole, let's read the whole passage. And then we'll come back and highlight those. We'll read it from the top to get the flow. You have heard that it hath been said, thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you, that ye may be the children of your Father which is in heaven. For he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and he sendeth rain on the just and the unjust. If ye love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do ye not even the publicans the same? If you salute your brethren only, what do ye more than others? Do not even the publicans so? Be ye therefore perfect or mature, even as your Father which in heaven is perfect. So what he's saying here is, if you only show kindness and respect and a willingness to help those that are in need, to the people that you like or that you love, you're no worse, or you're no better, rather. If you love those which love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans the same? And to put it lightly, saying someone was similar to a publican was probably the worst societal slur that anyone could have in the first century. You know, the publicans, based on public opinion, they had sold out their countrymen. You know, they collected taxes for Rome, and the taxes were, you know, X amount, and then they charged these enormous fees on top of what the actual tax was, so they themselves could get rich. And they were just universally despised. And then, of course, the Lord called Matthew, Levi, a publican, to be one of his disciples, right? But there is no, you know, the cultural slurs today are different than publicans, but unfortunately we don't have to say them out loud. You know what they are. But this was the worst slur, okay, that you could say against anyone. You know, they're like a publican. And he's saying, listen, even the publicans that are dishonest, that are greedy, that show no degree of spirituality at all, even they like the people that like them, right? They love the people that love them, and boy, they love hating the people they hate, right? That's no different than the world, is what he's saying. The world shows love to people that have something that's advantageous to me. But if there's no advantageous arrangement And I know that you, you know, hate my guts. Well, you know, the world wants to exact revenge on that person. And that's going back to the previous section. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you, turn the other cheek. And the lesson there is, don't exact revenge. But our flesh wants to get revenge, right? Our flesh wants to get even. But what is a disciple of Christ called to? Now, when we say love our enemies, okay, I think he expounds on this, the Holy Spirit expounds on this further in Romans chapter 12 that we'll get to in just a minute. You know, depending on the severity of your enemy, okay, it is probably very prudent for you to take precaution if there's a concern for physical safety, right? You know, I think about David. I think David is a very good example of this. And this is sobering. We never want to be in the negative position of being in the Saul territory. But you know, David, his chief enemy was Saul, who was a child of God, who was stirred up with jealousy, and he legitimately hated David. He was sure enough his enemy. And Saul was in the wrong in doing that at every step of the way. But, you know, David, when he was about to be killed, he ran away because there was physical danger there. Like, if you're in physical danger, showing love to your enemy is not giving them a big hug so they can stab you in the back, right? That's not the point here. The point is that we should show a general degree of kindness during times of need to anyone who stands in those need. And there can be a great testimony. That's what's meant by that you may be the children of God. Not that you become a child of God, not that you get born again, but you manifest your witness as the light of the world and the salt of the earth when you do something that is so contrary to what happens in the world, right? When you show kindness to offer, the language in Romans 12 says, a cup of water or a meal to your enemy. Well, people that know the animosity that that person has toward you, but you show them kindness when they are in a time of need, that is a tremendous testimony to the glory of Jesus Christ and to the love of Jesus Christ. But when he says love your, you don't love your enemy, that is your, where you have a degree of fear of physical violence, right? You don't love them the same way you love your wife and your children. What he's saying here is you show kindness and respect when there's time of need. And there's passages we'll read here in just a little bit that exhibit that. But what did David do? Well, you know what? His enemy, Saul, a child of God, no less. Bless his heart. Bless his broad way that leads to destruction heart for much of his life, unfortunately. David was in physical danger, so he had to hide in caves. But, you know, there were two opportunities where David had the ability to do what would have been that he was the anointed, okay? He was God's choice to be the king. So, you know, many people, and that was what the people around him, you know, we don't know their spiritual nature, but you know what? Hey, if we are on the run because this king is trying to kill you, and in two separate occasions, David, you have the right, or the ability, you have the ability to end this right now. And you're not just killing some enemy. No, you're taking your rightful spot, right? You've already been told you're the anointed. You've been told you're supposed to be the king. But David said, I will not stretch forth my hand against the Lord's anointed. Why? Because the Lord is going to judge Saul for what he's doing. And then in one of the occasions, he just cut off the edge of his skirt just to show Saul that he could have killed him. And even just doing that, his conscience was so smitten that he felt horrible afterwards, just that he'd cut off the hem of his garment just to show, hey, I could have killed you. So he loved his enemy by doing what? By forsaking what all of the military people around him had allegiance to David, they were telling him, end this now. And then this just tells you how people, again, we don't know their spiritual nature. I think there may have even been some language that said, the Lord has brought him into your hand. Look, the Lord brought him to you to end this today, right? But what did he say? No, that's not the right way to do things, right? The Lord's going to handle him. And it's not up to me to kill Saul. You know, Saul ends up dying in battle because of his own foolishness. So when David exhibited that, you know, he loved his enemy. But there's certainly, you know, if there's a fear for physical safety, you need to remove from your physical presence, right? So love your enemies. Bless them that curse you. Boy, there's Jesus, it says, and this tells you he's God, okay? Because we're not. When he was reviled, what did he do? He reviled not again. I mean, there's just, it doesn't matter how shy you are, how introverted you are. There, when someone says something about you that is a blatant falsehood, there's nothing inside of you that wants to sit there and be quiet and allow that public slander to happen, right? But what did Jesus do? He commended himself to him that judges righteously. So when he was reviled, you know, bless them that curse you. We don't have any abortion clinics here in this area. But, you know, I think a lot of these verses that we're talking about here today, you know, there's some Old Baptists in other parts of the country that they have those in their locality, and they stood out in front of abortion clinics. But, you know, if you've ever seen videos of those, of the people that are out there, you know, the only thing that a pro-life believer is doing is just saying, hey, that life begins at conception. We don't believe you should take the life of someone that's not your life. And it's just murder. That's all it is. And you know what? All we're doing is, all Christians that are protesting at abortion clinics would be doing is just standing up and saying, we believe in life. We believe in protection. And it is just unreal the type of just viciousness and just ungodly speech that seeps out of people in defending their right to murder innocent babies. And you know, again, I haven't been there. But, you know, if we're just simply here, we're not being rude to the opposing protesters. You know, we don't desire them any ill will. We're just saying, hey, it's wrong to murder babies inside that building, right? Well, you know what? If someone looks at you and says you're a da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know, it's hard in the purity of your heart. Now I think some of us could be snarky and say, I'm going to pray for you. Right? But in the purity of your heart, to really pity them and say, you know what, I'm going to pray for you. And you know what, if you've ever seen videos like that in front of abortion clinics, you will realize that telling that person that has just hurled all those insults against you, that I hope the Lord blesses you and your family, and I'm going to pray for you, it makes them madder. It makes them escalate even further. And I think that's very much a depiction of what the book of Acts calls being cut to the heart. But, you know, it's just hard. Like, if you were in that type of a setting and someone is just hurling all this just ridiculous stuff at you, there is just nothing inside your flesh that wants to look at them and say, you know what, God bless you. In sincerity of heart, not being smart aleck. In sincerity of heart, say, I'm going to pray for you. God bless you. But you know what? If we do that, and see, that's really important that we maintain, if you're ever in a setting like that, that you maintain your witness to the glory of Jesus. Because if you start acting like them, and you got it in you, okay? And you better mortify it. Because when someone starts talking to you like that, it could easily seep out, but it's a great witness to say, you know what, I'm going to absorb and deflect and ignore all that foolishness that you just said. And you know what, God, I hope God blesses you, you know. I hope God blesses you and your family. And there's other settings as well, but I think the vividness, if you've ever seen those videos out in front of abortion clinics, it's so vivid in those videos that you just have this wickedness on one side and peaceful standing up for the truth on one side. But the more kindness you show them, the madder and the madder and the madder they get. And again, I think that's exhibited in Romans chapter 12 that we'll see here in just a minute. Do good to them that hate you. I mean, that's just not in our nature. Pray for them which despitefully use you and persecute you. You know, Jesus, when he was on the cross, he said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." And Stephen was being stoned for righteousness' sake. The last words he said before he was wafted up into heaven, when he saw Jesus standing on the right hand of God to welcome him into heaven, the last thing he said here in this world was, "Lord, lay not this sin to their charge." Another reason why it's vitally important that we respond this way is because we do not know the state of a person's heart when we're interacting with them. And you know what? They might be Saul of Tarsus on the road to Damascus today, but they may be Saul of Tarsus arriving in Damascus tomorrow. Okay? And you know what? They can look back and say, "You know what? Paul said there, describing his experience in Romans 7, when all of that stuff flooded back into my mind, and I didn't know sin unless what was the law told me what sin was. I've never felt the conviction in my heart because my heart had not been touched by the grace of God. But when all of that came rushing back into his mind, I guarantee you, you know what he thought about? When he held the coats of those that stoned Stephen, he thought about Stephen saying, "Lord, lay not this sin to their charge." And you know what that proved to him? What these people believe is real. What these people believe is authentic, right? And you don't know. Somebody might be unregenerate today, and the way that you respond to them in the right way could make them call you years later and say, "You know what? I did not have the convictions in years past that I have today, but I can see now I was 1,000% in the wrong in the way that I interacted with you, but you didn't retaliate. You responded the way that Jesus would have responded. You responded with these passages right here." And you know what? What I believe, what you've practiced, what you've preached, and I believe what you believe is all. Where is it that you go to church? Right? We don't know the state that people are in, and some person that might be our enemy today. I mean, I can't fathom how difficult it must have been for all of those first century Jews to truly believe the conversion of Saul of Tarsus was authentic, right? It feels everything like a Trojan horse, doesn't it? It feels everything like he's just saying this to get the names of everybody. But you know what? It's a real possibility that somebody that is our enemy today, he might be our brother in Christ tomorrow. We don't know. That's according to the Lord's will. But what we don't want to do is ruin our witness of Christ and of the church by us acting in the flesh just like they act in the flesh, right? Because if they're pursuing something and they see that you know what, I was 1,000% in the wrong, but they acted just as much in the wrong as I was, I might go to church somewhere, but it ain't going to be with that guy, right? So we have a tremendous public witness when people that know the facts and the circumstances see that this person is so ridiculous and so much in the wrong, but we respond with the love of Christ, with the grace of Christ, that ye may be the children, that we can publicly manifest what the love of Jesus Christ means on a day in, day out basis, right? And the way we interact with others. Now, it's also vitally important that we remind ourselves, Romans chapter 5, As we interact with those that might probably consider us their enemies or vice versa, that the reason why we're called to show love to them is because Christ loved us when we were his enemies. Okay? Romans 5, verse 10. For if when we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son, much more being reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. So it is vitally important that we always remind ourselves that yes, we have the grace and the fellowship of God now, but we were, and that word enemy in Matthew chapter 5 literally just means the root of it is just hatred. Okay? And it's hard for me to fact because I love God. I hope that, you know, we're all striving to obey the greatest commandment to the best of our ability, to love God with all of our heart, soul, and mind, and love our neighbors ourself. But it's hard for me to fathom that in my nature, apart from the grace of God, I didn't love God, I hated God. And it's hard for me to fathom that. But when God showed that love toward me, when I was an enemy toward him, right? And I have to be reminded of that when I'm tempted to lose my cool with someone who has cursed me, that has despitefully used me, that's persecuted me, or whatever fits your case, okay? Romans 12. I think this kind of gives us a further exposition of this. Maybe it'll make a little bit more sense. Romans 12, verse 14. Bless them which persecute you, bless and curse not. Okay, so if someone hurls verbal attacks on you, respond the way that Jesus would respond, right? But also, I say that. You have to be reminded you're not God, okay? You can't talk to people, regardless of what you think in your own mind. You can't go around telling people you're of your father the devil, right? Jesus did, right? You can't talk the way Jesus talked all the time. But you should respond in a way that honors Jesus Christ. All right, let's skip down to verse 17. Recompense to no man evil for evil. That's what he's saying there, is that you don't retaliate and try to plot revenge against those that have done evil. You commend them over God. God can handle this situation way better than I can. He can judge them, you know, and I'm limited in my judgment, by the way. God is unlimited in his judgment to destroy their life if that's according to his will, okay? If it be possible, as much as lieth in you, live peaceably with all men. And some, as much as lieth in you, some people, the way that you live peaceably with them is we're just not in the same room. It's just reality, all right? Dearly beloved, avenge not yourself, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Give it over to the Lord. But this is the verse that I think really expounds on what we're trying to learn today. Therefore, if thine enemy hunger, feed him. If he thirst, give him drink. Now again, you want to do it with a purity of heart to where you're trying to honor the Lord. But there's also some degree of maybe our spiritual flesh that probably gets some satisfaction. The way I get back at him is being nice to him. Well, I hope we have a little bit more purity of heart than that. But it also is somewhat satisfying to us to know that by means of that, that's how you heap fire of coals on his head. Right? The way you get back at him is by, as the old saying goes, killing them with kindness. Right? And the lesson here, let's go to Luke chapter 10 of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan. The lesson here is that if your enemy is in a similar spot to this man who is in dire need, you know, if your enemy, again, we live in a lot different world than they lived in. You know, there's hotels that you can get for low prices. There's gas stations in every corner where you can get some water. You know, we just live in an entirely different world than they did when this was written. But if there was a circumstance where your enemy showed up at your door and says, I have nothing to eat, and my family is not going to, I'm not going to be able to provide for my family. I would, depending on the severity of that relationship, I don't think I would necessarily offer him a bed for the night. But you know what? I can go in there to my refrigerator and give him some food and some drink and say, God bless you. I'm going to pray for you, right? That's what he's saying here. There's a level of respect and kindness and gratitude that we should have with every single person that we interact with, regardless of if they hate me or if they love me, right? Now, you know, God says, I send rain on both the just and the unjust. I get, you know, the unjust, the wicked, reprobate farmer, if his crops line up and back up to the godly, righteous farmer, you know, the Lord can treat it like Egypt and Goshen. You know, he could. But the way that the Lord typically deals with that is that both of the people in that general area, they both get the rain that they need, right? And if the Lord gives them those kind of basic necessities to be able to feed their family, who are you to withhold those basic necessities if you have the ability to help them in that way, right? Now, this really gets to the heart of the matter of the definition of a neighbor. Okay, that's what the Jews wanted to know. What's the definition of a neighbor? And I need someone to validate my thoughts, my preferences, that I want that definition to be restricted so narrowly that it's definitely in this day only a Jew. And not only that, it's only the Jews I like. Because publicans were Jews too, right? You know? And we definitely don't want to. Let's just make sure, Jesus, you are not talking about publicans, right? I just want to make sure that I do have the right to hate a publican, right? Even though they are a Jew. So, Luke 10, 25, there's a certain lawyer stood up and tempted him. Again, they weren't presenting this with a sincere heart. Master, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? What's written in the law? And he answered, love the Lord with all your heart, soul, and mind, and thy neighbor as thyself. Now, kind of think, you know, maybe he came up with this on his own. I kind of tend to think he was in the audience when he heard Jesus say this before. I don't think he just randomly got it perfectly right. I think he had heard Jesus already say this, most likely. So he gave to the teacher what he knew the right answer was, right? He said unto him, this thou hast answered right, this do and live. Thou shalt live. Not that you're going to be born again, but you're going to have a great joy in the abundant life if you do that, right? But he, willing to justify himself, because that lawyer, you know, he knew there were some people he didn't like. Who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? And I'm going to presume you know the parable of the Good Samaritan. And this is not presented as a parable. It could be. But I think it's most likely that this was a true event that was public, that may, to varying degrees, may have been publicly known. And again, these are all assumptions, but, you know, a certain lawyer, you know, the Lord told something Nicodemus, only the Lord and Nicodemus really knew what happened under the fig tree. You know, and again, this is all conjecture, but it makes you think, kind of makes you wonder if maybe this lawyer, maybe him and the Lord were the only people that knew that maybe he was the guy, one of those first two guys that passed by, right? Maybe so, I don't know. But the general idea here is there's a man that went down from Jericho that fell among thieves. And he's beaten, and he's destitute and half dead in the ditch. And then, by chance, verse 31, by the providence of God, there was a priest that came by. But he saw him, and you know, he passed by on the other side of the road. Again, we don't have time to preach the Good Samaritan the way that we need to, so we're having to skim the top. But then a Levite came by. You know, these godly, religious priests and Levites. And what did he do? He came and he looked on him. And he said, no, I'm busy. Just keep going. Passed by on the other side. But a certain Samaritan, and there is no Jew in this day outside of Jesus Christ that wanted to put the Samaritans in the category of a neighbor. And I guarantee you, they all of them would have viewed them as an enemy. And there may have been, this man was, the implication is this is a Jewish man that was down in the ditch. And if the roles were reversed, this is the point that Jesus is getting to here. This Samaritan that helped the Jew, if the Samaritan was the one in the ditch and there were any identifying marks of him being a Samaritan, every Jew would have passed by on the other side. So the point is, if the roles were reversed, if the situations were reversed, and these Jews were able to identify that this man was a Samaritan, they had been so misguided by their religious teachers. Not only do I not have to help him, I don't have to show any love to him because he is not my neighbor, but I can still stay in my position of hating him because he's my enemy, right? Well, what happened when the roles were reversed? The Samaritan, who was the beaten man's enemy in his own mind, what did he do? He's the one who picked him up out of the ditch. He's the one who brought him to the inn. He's the one who paid the innkeeper, and anything else he owes, I'll pay it when I come back. So what did... I love these lawyers that are tempting Jesus, and then he boxes them into a corner. Now, which one of these three thinkest thou was neighbor unto him that fell among the thieves? And then he just couldn't bring himself to say the word Samaritan, right? He that showed mercy on him. And the word I missed, by the way, this is important, verse 33. It was a certain Samaritan, he journeyed, he came where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion on him. That's what he means by loving your enemies. Compassion. We don't have to give him a room in our house, we don't have to give him a hug, but if there's a circumstance where our enemy has a physical need and we have the ability to help them with that physical need, it is a great honor to Jesus Christ to help them in that way, right? And again, this lawyer, he asked the question with the wrong intentions, and now he's been boxed into a corner. And again, he just refuses to say Samaritan, but he had to begrudgingly say that the Samaritan was the best of these three, right? And then what does Jesus say? Go and do thou likewise, right? Go help those that are in need. And if you look at someone, and in that day, if you look at them as some identifier of their ethnicity, and you say, I'm not going to, if it's a person that I hate, that hates me, so therefore they did. I don't know the circumstances of how they ended up in the ditch, but they probably deserved it. You might be right. They might deserve it. You know, but you know what? You have the ability to help them in a natural way. And if the Lord brings that opportunity in your way, it is a great testimony to Jesus Christ to help people in a natural way, regardless. The point is, it doesn't matter your personal interaction with them. What matters is you honoring the Lord by the obedience to the said command. And this is the tagline. This is the tagline that I think the Jews left off that maybe we might want to leave off to. Love your neighbor. Okay, I can do that. As thyself. That solves a lot of problems when you get that right. You know, as thyself. If you look at the back half of the Ten Commandments, if you just love your neighbor as yourself, that solves all of the interpersonal back half of the Ten Commandments. Murder, theft, covetousness, all this stuff. Well, you're not going to do that to yourself, right? Loving your neighbor as yourself solves a whole... Because we all love ourselves, right? I'm not going to leave myself down in the ditch, right? I'm not going to leave myself without food. I'm not going to leave myself without water, right? So if I love my neighbor as myself... Then that really clarifies for me what I should try to do as much as life within me for those that are in need, regardless of my personal interactions with them. If we do that, we honor Jesus Christ and we glorify Jesus Christ, and we can have a great witness and testimony to the love that He has toward us.